Well, I feel a little bit at a disadvantage here because I haven't been able to attend most of the classes that Pastor Rayburn has taught. It may come as a shock to some of you in this room, but there are spiritually minded people in this church. And they came to my classes on Psalm 119, believe it or not. While you are all in here otherwise engaged. But I do have the advantage of having my dear wife having attended these classes, and then she would come home and summarize the class for me. And it would usually boil down to something like this. Pastor Rayburn says, you don't know anything about male and female relationships. Or my personal favorite, Pastor Rayburn says, you don't know anything about talking to women. So I stand before you today as one who's also learning about all this more deeply from a spiritual perspective. These issues do resonate with us, as they should. Because, as you know, and as has been repeated here, God has created us male and female, has created us sexual beings, and we have many similarities, but we have some profound and striking differences as well. My goals today are fairly straightforward. I just want to highlight for you a few of the physiologic differences between men and women as God has created them. And we want to think about those differences in the light of Scripture, especially with respect to husbands loving their wives. And finally, we want to consider the consequences of what we might call sex gone wrong, the myriad diseases and the disorders and the mayhem that results from sexual enterprise outside of God's ordinances for it. So let me announce the first heading. I don't know if I have something to write with. I want you to think about this word in particular today in this context. And the word is seasons. This is an important word. If you look it up in Webster's Third New International Dictionary, you will find at least seven or so different major definitions for this word. I want to use this word today in two senses. The first will be the sense of a suitable or fitting time or occasion. So a suitable or fitting time or occasion. Okay. Secondly, and a related definition. Secondly, a period of time. I'm going to write these up here so they'll be important for us to refer to. A period of time made significant or characterized Thank you. I appreciate the support because we're obviously having a good time next door. Period of time characterized or made significant by a particular feature that's enough a particular
I got donuts over there.
Yeah.
Are you going,
Micah? He's going next door. All right, a particular feature, circumstance, or event. Now, if you look at these definitions, you can see that these two senses of the word season are related. Both senses feature time as a prominent feature in the definition, but they're also a little bit different. In the first sense, the time is suitable or fitting or appropriate, and in the second time, the time itself is characterized or defined by some other specific event. Right? My argument today that I want to present before you is that God has made women inherently seasonal in the second sense, in their physiology, in their biology. In a way that he has not made men. Okay, men are not necessarily seasonal in this sense, physiologically. Women's lives, physiologically, are broken up into periods of time characterized and defined by profound hormonal events in their bodies. And this is the way God has made them. Men do not experience life in this way. We do not have an internal seasonality in the same way that women do. And because we do not have an internal seasonality, it's vitally important that we learn to recognize seasons in women as men, and a lot of other things as well. In this second sense, season being a period of time characterized by particular events, so that then we may learn to act seasonally in the first sense, acting at suitable times and occasions. Okay? And I think if you think about it, the Bible, God in His Word, spends a lot of time trying to convince us of these things and driving home these points. It's in the realm of sexual relations where these physiologic and spiritual realities may show themselves at their best and at their worst. Deepening harmony can result between a husband and a wife when the husband learns to think and act seasonally, acting at suitable fitting times and occasions, because he recognizes that in her, especially, that she has periods of time that are defined by other things going on in her life and going on in her physiology. All manner of mayhem occurs when men pursue sex out of season, as they so frequently do. So I want you to look at a couple of texts and think about what I'm going to tell you about physiology in the light of these texts, please. And these are familiar texts. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, very familiar text. If you look at different translations of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, the translations of verse 5 have changed over time. The one I'm going to read to you is from the English Standard Version of the Bible, I believe. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, starting at verse 1, "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing." Now, if you think about that text, the preacher in Ecclesiastes is talking about time in the first sense, suitable fitting times or occasions for certain things. There's a time under heaven, a season for everything, for everything. And then Leviticus chapter 15, starting at verse 19. "When a woman has a discharge and the discharge in her body is blood, she shall be in her menstrual impurity for 7 days. And whoever touches her shall be unclean until the evening. And everything on which she lies during her menstrual impurity shall be unclean. Everything also on which she sits shall be unclean. And whoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. And whoever touches anything on which she sits shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. Whether it is the bed or anything on which she sits, when he touches it, he shall be unclean until the evening. And if any man lies with her and her menstrual impurity comes upon him, he shall be unclean 7 days. And every bed on which he lies shall be unclean." And you might think this is calling you to a recognition of seasons in the second sense. There are periods of time that are made significant by particular features going on in the life of the woman, and we are called upon to recognize that. Okay? Now, let's think about human physiology for just a little bit. You want to take notes, this will be on the exam. No, know, in all seriousness, don't get bound up in the details here, but I just want to give you enough to impress upon you the complexity of what we are dealing with here. Okay? We are indeed fearfully and wonderfully made, and I just want you to get a sense of that. I'm going to start with the physiology of the reproductive system in women, very briefly, and this is very broad overview, and there are large texts written about this sort of material. We look first at the female reproductive system because that is the system that produces seasonality in women. It is also obviously intimately tied to sexual function, which has been the subject of this class in many ways. The organs involved are the brain, the ovaries, the breasts, the uterus, and the vagina. Hormones are made in the brain and in the ovaries, and these hormones are numerous, and they are precisely regulated to produce the menstrual cycle. And that is what gives women, in large extent, their sense of seasons internally. The first menstrual period, or menarche, we call it, menarche, occurs after a number of other developmental milestones have been reached, such as breast development, which is produced generally by the estrogen, even at low levels, secreted from the ovaries. In the United States, girls experience menarche at an average age of 12.7 years, and even younger ages if they are African-American girls. The various events that kick off the development of the menstrual cycle in women at that age are not understood. It's really not known in great detail. If we're going to start the hormone story, we start in the hypothalamus. And then down to the pituitary gland, which sits under the hypothalamus. And for you Latin scholars in the room, Mr. Pfefferly, I'm sure will know this. The word in Latin, pituitarius, means? Doesn't know. Pastor Rayburn teaches level 4 Latin. Pituitarius?
Little tiny gland below the hypothalamus.
Yeah.
Nestled under.
Do you know what it means in Latin? It means snot. Okay. It means...
I don't know those kinds of things.
I would have thought that... You've got boys. I thought that would have been a particular focus of your learning. It was thought that the pituitary produces mucus. And... that's my understanding of where that term came from. Anyway, that's what the dictionary says. The hypothalamus, these are neurons in the brain, but they actually make a hormone called gonadotropin-releasing hormone, which we write this way, gonadotropin-releasing hormone. This goes to the pituitary and stimulates the pituitary to make two hormones, one of which is called luteinizing hormone and the other is called follicle stimulating hormone. Both of these hormones then go to the ovaries. And cause all sorts of changes there. What's very interesting to me about gonadotropin-releasing hormone is that this hormone has to be released in a periodic or pulsatile manner by the hypothalamus. If you give someone gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and this is actually a fairly simple, I think it's a 10-peptide chain, it's a fairly simple molecule, but if you give somebody an infusion of this continuously, it will shut the pituitary down. The pituitary will not make these hormones in the levels they're supposed to. This has to be pulsatile in the female brain. Otherwise, it don't work. Okay? We divide the menstrual cycle into two periods. And, of course, we think the typical menstrual cycle is going to be 28 days. with ovulation occurring somewhere around the middle. And we talk about the follicular phase and the luteal phase. And all this really means is that in the first half, you have the development of the follicle and the ovary to generally hopefully produce one egg, not multiple eggs, per month. At this point, you have ovulation. And then you have a luteal phase where in the ovary, the ruptured follicle persist for some time. So you have an ovary, you have a follicle that ruptures and releases an egg, and then what you have left is called the corpus luteum. Which in Latin means, Mr. Fefferly? Oh. Well, you got body right. The yellow body, okay. Luteinizing hormone and corpus luteum all refer to yellow, and this looks yellow, I guess, and so it's called the yellow body. When the follicle ruptures, the egg is released. You have left a corpus luteum, and it is that corpus luteum in the ovary that is producing estrogen and progesterone and is developing the uterus in such a way that if fertilization occurs and implantation occurs, that developing baby is going to have a place to land and to be nourished and to be sustained. Okay? So it is toward the middle of the cycle when you start getting hormone levels surging, things like progesterone and estrogen building up in the female body and then tailing off later. If you don't have fertilization, you don't have implantation of a baby into the uterus, the corpus luteum over time will degenerate over a couple of weeks and it will stop making all of these hormones, and the woman then will experience the bleeding that occurs at the end of the cycle when she has her menses, her menstrual period. All of that will slough off. You start the cycle over again. Right? If, on the other hand, you have fertilization and implantation of a baby in the uterus, some of the cells of the baby itself will make another hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin, which will then sustain the corpus luteum. And it will keep the corpus luteum going for another 6 to 10 weeks. So that the corpus luteum will keep making hormones, the uterus will be sustained, and then eventually the baby's placenta will take over the hormone production and sustain the baby through the rest of the pregnancy. That's the reason why there are a lot of miscarriages at around 6 to 10 weeks, because if the placenta hasn't developed enough, but the corpus luteum degenerates for some reason, you lose that pregnancy. Okay? These hormones acting on the ovaries also, when you start making estrogen and progesterone, other hormones, these hormones go back and feed back into the brain and feed back into the pituitary. I'm just telling you, it's a very complex system. So that you have positive effects here, you have negative effects here, all very finely balanced, all very finely tuned to produce a cycle every month or so. Okay? Have I confused you hopelessly now with this? Are there questions about this part of it? Yes, sir.
Just a comment, I guess. It just occurred to me, it's funny how all this happened just by chance.
That's what I always say. It's just amazing how this happened by chance. Yes. Yes, sir.
But also after the delivery of the child, as I remember, there's about a 6-month period of inability to conceive again.
Mm-hmm. Well, another pituitary hormone called prolactin, which is involved and in terms of female breast development, that's a whole other issue. Female breast development, milk production, and so on, and some of its feedback then on the hypothalamus and the pituitary in terms of making FSH and LH, and so you have a suppression of the cycle and so on and so forth. You can also see in this cycle that you can see some targets then for, and I'm not planning on getting into this today because I don't have time, but you can see some targets then for birth control, and this is where birth control pills, the idea comes from, is specifically these negative feedback loops that if you give a woman estrogen and progesterone, you basically turn off this system in the brain and produce less of these hormones. You don't produce ovulation then. That's the whole idea behind birth control pills, is to suppress ovulation by suppressing these hormones up here.
Okay. I may add, there's also an interesting thing that you differ from animals, that some animals don't have a 30-day period, but 6 months or whatever.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of different mammals have different cycles, different periods. But this is what we are dealing with in human beings. So, now, during the cycle, women will experience, some women certainly will experience various symptoms through their cycle. Ovulation itself may cause a pain when the follicle ruptures at mid-cycle, and that's called by the German term Mittelschmerz. That's the term. That's the medical term, Mittelschmerz. If you have pain with ovulation, middle pain, and from Schmerz we get the idea of that smarts. Okay, that's my understanding where that smarts comes from. There are also what we call milliminal symptoms of varying degrees. Milliminal being the premenstrual time frame. Bloating, breast tenderness, food cravings may occur, among other things. The body temperature rises by 1/2 to 1 degree Fahrenheit in the second half of the menstrual cycle, apparently due to progesterone's effect on the hypothalamus. Some women experience excessive bleeding at the time of the menses. This is termed menorrhagia. We call that menorrhagia. Others experience abnormalities of the cycle of excessive bleeding at irregular times. We call this menometrorrhagia. This is why doctors use abbreviations a lot, because you have to write all these long words out. Menstruation that is painful is also a common problem. This is called dysmenorrhea. Dysmenorrhea is painful menses. And, of course, a woman may have all of these things. Crampy lower abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea, fatigue, headache. It's estimated that up to 60 to 90% of adolescent girls experience some dysmenorrhea, and it may be severe in as many as 15% of girls in that age group. Okay? Now, this is not to say that all women experience these things. Of course not. Everybody's different. But in general, these are the things that women may experience because God has created them seasonal, and this is a reality. Now, let's look at the physiology of the reproductive system in men. And we start again in the brain.
Brian, would you explain
yes.
something? I didn't get the negatives of estrogen. I know it's probably very important, but why is that a negative?
Negative feedback. If you think about a cycle with hormones, hormones can have positive effects. They can also have negative effects. They can suppress other functions. So the estrogen and progesterone, one of the keys to the cycle is that they actually have negative effects. They actually blunt the release of gonadotropin-releasing hormone in the hypothalamus. They actually go to the pituitary and blunt luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone. So that's what a negative feedback is.
But only for a while.
But only for a while.
Okay.
And it's
so
actually...
So that it wouldn't be a continuous emission of GnRH.
Yeah. Right. Right. This will be suppressed at certain parts of the cycle. It will be augmented at other parts of the cycle. There are actually other hormones that the ovary releases, some of which are negative and some of which are positive. But I can give you the...
Here.
This is not... By the way, this is not my area of expertise. I'm not a gynecologist. I'm an internist. If you want to talk about high blood pressure and high cholesterol, I'm your guy. But I had to go back and kind of read up on this myself. Okay. Let's look at the physiology in men. And we really start with most of the same hormones and most of the same organs. We change the word ovaries to testis. Testes. And we change the words progesterone and estrogen to testosterone. But in many ways, this is a similar system. We still have gonadotropin-releasing hormone in the hypothalamus. We still have pituitary function and production of luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone. The difference being that the target is different. Luteinizing hormone goes to the testes and binds to a surface receptor on a certain type of cell called a Leydig cell, L-E-Y-D-I-G, named after a doctor. Leydig cells make testosterone, and they also do so in a cyclical manner. All right, so men are cyclical also. The difference being, if you look at a testosterone cycle like this, the difference is this is not 28 days down here. This is 24 hours. Okay? There is. This is our season, folks. This is 8 a.m. And this is 8 p.m. Literally, there is a diurnal variation in hormones. The peak is usually roughly around 8, and the trough is around 8 p.m.
Is it kicked off by coffee? Is that?
I hadn't thought of that, but that's probably right. Okay. So we cycle as well, but the effects are not obviously not as noticeable as it is in women. Testosterone. Testosterone is metabolized. This may surprise you a bit, but testosterone made in the testis is metabolized into a couple of other hormones, one of which is called dihydrotestosterone, or DHT. The other one, interestingly enough, is estradiol, or basically estrogen, okay? And, for instance, very interesting that male libido is probably strongly influenced by this hormone, this female hormone, or what we think of as a female hormone. Women make testosterone, too. These hormones are all very related, and it's not too many steps to go from testosterone to estrogen and vice versa. It's the relative concentrations of things in the body that make the difference. But there are case reports of men who lack the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction, and if they don't make estradiol, they lack libido. And if you give them then female sex hormones, their libido will normalize. And everything else works because they do have testosterone, they just don't have estrogen. Sir?
I hear quite the adverse in that testosterone low libido element, and the women who have high levels of testosterone.
Well, in women. I'm just telling you a case report in men.
I had kind of an interesting question. You know, as we get older, men produce less testosterone, women produce less estrogen.
Yes.
So we have the corollary, right? We carry estrogen and they carry testosterone. I'm wondering, if through the aging process, we kind of become hormone less, or are they more or less balance out?
Over time, for instance, men, by the time a man is 80, he will have about half, 25% to half of the testosterone levels that he had when he was 20. Okay, so there is a gradual diminution. Obviously, women at the time of the menopause lose considerable hormone influence because of the loss of ovarian function. Okay, they don't have the estrogen and progesterone as much anymore. So there are significant changes that occur with age. Yes, sir.
Be interested in some anecdotal evidence from
maybe your own? I don't know. We might be. I don't know.
No.
Well, let's. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Is this why older men, like in the 80s, are wiser than the mix of younger men?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. I think because you're not confused anymore by hormones. Well, and that's all true. I mean, over time. You know, one of the effects of, or many of the effects of testosterone are on things like, you know, in adolescence, long bone growth, muscle development, the vocal cords, obviously, male pattern hair growth. All of those things are influenced by testosterone. And with age, there is loss of testosterone. There is a decline in libido because you're going to have less estradiol. There's going to be a decline in muscle strength. There's going to be a loss of lean muscle mass and so on with age. There's a reduction of bone mineral density with age and a loss of strength and energy. So these are some of the changes that we do experience over time. But I just wanted to demonstrate for you again, women are seasonal in ways that men are not. And I want you to think about the implications of that. For the woman, her sexual hormone cycle, her libido is going to vary in many cases. Her sense of physical well-being is going to fluctuate. Her outlook may change from week to week. For her, the only constant is change. This is an oversimplification. Obviously, the degree of variation of these things will vary from woman to woman, but the broad point is true. Women are seasonal by nature. This is the way God has made them. And just as the rest of the world is seasonal, the way God has made it. And in general, men are not. Barring disease, we feel pretty much the same today as we did on any given day in the past 5 years. Our libido is just intense today, as it will be next Friday, and as it was a month ago Tuesday. You know, as we say now in Gig Harbor, as we cross the new bridge, we are good to go. We are. I have to be so careful in this one. So careful. The Pfizer Global Study of Sexual Attitudes and Behaviors is a survey of over 27,500 people in 29 different countries. The surveyors found that 63% of women and 83% of men aged 40 to 80 describe sex as extremely important, very important, or moderately important. That's 40 to 80-year-olds. Okay. So the importance of sex to people who are middle-aged, elderly, is quite high. And I can tell you that as a physician. We see those folks all the time, and it is still an area of interest. Furthermore, other studies have demonstrated consistently that far more women than men report experiencing sexual problems. 43% of U.S. women versus 31% of men. 54% of British women versus 35% of men. And in Australia, a fairly macho country, 71% of the women report sexual difficulties versus 46% of the men. Women are more likely than men to report being unable to achieve orgasm, not finding sex pleasurable, experiencing physical pain during intercourse, and worrying during sex that their body looks unattractive. Science so far has paid little attention to female sexual function and satisfaction. The following is a direct quote from a 2006 chapter on female sexuality that appears in the American College of Physicians medicine text. Quote, "Studies of the anatomy, physiology, and pathophysiology of female sexual dysfunction and function are limited. Much of what is known or inferred is extrapolated from animal studies, primarily in rodents, and drawn by analogy from studies in men." So take heart, ladies, we are studying the rats as we speak. The authors go on to summarize the complexities that researchers face this way. Quote, "Normal female sexual function involves intact neural, vascular, and muscular circuitry, complex interactions between multiple neurotransmitter systems, and critical modulating influences from the endocrine system." The endocrine system being, of course, the glandular system. "Numerous neurotransmitters, bioactive substances, and sex steroids appear to be involved. These include, but are probably not limited to, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, acetylcholine, nitric oxide, vasoactive intestinal peptide, prostaglandin E1, estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, oxytocin, and prolactin. Emerging evidence suggests that alpha melanocortin stimulating hormone may also play an important role. So, ladies, I'm sorry, but it appears it will be some time before the scientists have sorted out some of these issues for you. Remember that I asked you to think about these issues in the light of Scripture that we read earlier. The Ecclesiastes passage teaches us, all of us, about seasons, about a time for every purpose under heaven. And as sex is one of the purposes under heaven, there is a time for sex, and there is a time to refrain from sex. Women understand this more readily than men do, I think, because they feel the seasons in their bodies. For men, however, the sexual desire is more of a constant. It's always waiting to be satisfied. It is very easy for men to grow impatient, to apply subtle or overt pressure to their wives for sex at times when she really, really doesn't want to. Or even worse, to seek sex outside of the marriage. Even the secular medical texts admit that a large part of a woman's sexual satisfaction is dependent upon whether she feels truly loved in the relationship she has with her husband. Loving your wife as yourself, loving her sacrificially as Christ loves the church, does not come easily or naturally to men, but it can be learned, and it has to be learned over the course of a marriage. And I hope that a deeper recognition of the inherent biological differences between men and women as God has created them will help further that learning. Now, as a physician, I've seen far too many instances over the years of men seeking sex in the wrong places, at the wrong times, with the wrong partners. I actually know of women in their 90s, patients of mine, who are mourning the fact that they have never felt truly loved in their marriage, marriages that have been over decades, and they have never felt aroused by intimacy with their husband. They are still mourning this in their 90s. As Pastor Rayburn has reminded you, we live in a culture that treats sex as just another biological function like breathing and encourages our men, young and old, to view women as objects that exist to gratify their own desires whenever and wherever they wish. I was recently counseling a teenage girl who's a patient of mine. She's a beautiful young lady who's already on birth control pills at age 16. She's there with her mother, and both she and her mother treated it as if it is the most normal thing in the world for her to be having sex with a young man, a young boy, at this age. I asked her why she was having sex. She really had no ready answer, but both mother and daughter kind of looked at me like I had just arrived from another planet for even asking the question. I reminded her that should she become pregnant or develop a sexually transmitted infection, in all likelihood her last sight of the young man in question would be of those little puffs of dust going over the horizon, just like a Roadrunner cartoon. So let's think about, for just the few remaining minutes that we have, some of the consequences of sex gone wrong. First of all, I'm going to give you two more texts about, again, ignoring the seasons. Leviticus chapter 18, verses 19 to 20. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness while she is in her menstrual uncleanness, and, this is the and, you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. And then another familiar passage, 2 Samuel chapter 11. Note the seasons here. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." Consequences of ignoring the seasons and suitable occasions for every activity. A few statistics. According to the 2003 National Youth Behavior Risk Survey, 45% of young women have had penile vaginal intercourse by the end of high school. 4% have had intercourse before the age of 13. Of sexually active young women, 14% have had four or more sexual partners by age 19. Four or more partners by age 19. The pregnancy rate in young women 15 to 19 years of age is 84 cases per 1,000. Each year, one in four teenagers in the United States contracts a sexually transmitted infection, and over their lifetime, half of all people will contract a sexually transmitted infection. 21% of men and 13% of women report having had sex with someone other than their spouse while married. And keep in mind, these are just the folks who admit to it. At the end of 2005, an estimated 437,982 people in the United States were living with AIDS. In 2005, the last year for which we have data, 41,120 new cases of AIDS were reported in the United States. In 2005, primary and secondary syphilis cases reported to the Centers for Disease Control increased for the fifth consecutive year. In 2005, 976,445 new cases of chlamydia were reported in the United States. Chlamydia is a bacterially sexually transmitted infection which can damage a woman's reproductive organs and cause discharges and chronic scarring and other problems. 2005, there were 339,593 new cases of gonorrhea in the United States. That's just the reported cases. The estimates are that there are over 700,000 people in the U.S. that get new gonorrheal infections each year. ...33,278 new cases of syphilis. An estimated 75% of all reproductive age people have been infected with the sexually transmitted virus, human papillomavirus, which in some cases increases the risk for cervical cancer, and causes warts and skin lesions on genitalia.
Did you say 75% of all people?
All reproductive age people in the United States are estimated to be infected with human papillomavirus, HPV.
Question.
Sir.
Can we infer, since that's only communicated through sexual contact, that that earlier statistic is even, well, cumulatively up in that range where you said so many people are unfaithful over a period of time? And can we infer something from that?
Yeah, we can infer that people aren't honest with surveyors frequently.
That's an astounding, horrific statistic.
It is. It is. And it's the reality in the world out here. It's you know, the dictum in medicine is, and what we tell, and what I tell young people all the time is, when you have sex with someone, you're having sex with everyone who ever had sex with them. And that's the reality. And I told that young lady that. You know. So, it is true. And the frequency with which people are monogamous and are living in accordance with God's ordinances for marriage, it's a very tiny percentage of the population. And so these numbers are high. Human papillomavirus is very, very easily transmitted, and so it's very common.
Isn't that the one that they have on the vaccination
form?
Yes. Like the state of Texas is trying to amend the vaccination
instead of telling them that your instance, right, yeah, I would encourage both, obviously, because I think the vaccine is helpful, and it does demonstrate, you know, benefit in reducing rates of cervical cancer. But you need to do all of those things. Genital herpes. Where's my numbers on genital herpes? 45 million people ages 12 and older, or 1 out of 5 adolescents and adults have had genital herpes virus infection. Between the late 1970s and the early 1990s, shortly after the sexual revolution began, the number of Americans with genital herpes infection increased 30%. Trichomoniasis, one you may not have heard of, is the most common curable sexually transmitted disease in young sexually active women. An estimated 7.4 million new cases occur each year in women and men. This is a protozoan infection, and the vagina is the most common site of infection in women. And it's generally a fairly mild infection, which is why you don't hear about it a lot, but it is very common. So I am out of time. I'm going to just end with one last text for you today, just to think about in light of this information. In light of the other texts that you've already heard, this is another familiar text and one that Dr. Raymond has talked to you about previously. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. So I thank you for your time. If you have other questions, I'll hang out here for a minute. Yes, sir.
Somebody might know about World Magazine. Eugene V. A month ago had an article pointing out that about people like us, OPC, PCA, that's good for us. And he was saying that all these things we're talking about are as common in evangelical churches as they are out there in the general world. A lot of flabbergasted by that. Mm-hmm. Some of you know the situation in our family, our son-in-law. Mm-hmm. And a couple of college graduates
thing in the choir here?
Well, it points out...
I'd say that's typical, but something for us to think about.
It points out that we are all sinful people, and we are all completely dependent upon God for our salvation and for our sanctification and for all of those things. We are dependent upon the Lord for these things. These things do happen in the church because we are sinful people. Yes, sir.
With the hormones in our food source, beef products, poultry, pork, how much concern do we have for our children who are developing, I say, developing sexual organs? Is that something that we need to do that in terms of that?
You know, I don't know, because we're talking about a number of hormones that are applied in agricultural settings, growth hormone and so on. You know, I don't know that anybody's convincingly demonstrated that that's a problem, but just because they haven't demonstrated it doesn't mean that it isn't. And so I'm not sure I have a good answer for you on that. If you want to be really, really diligent and safe, then go hormone-free and be careful. But I don't know of anything that I could show you and say, well, we know that this causes a problem.
Is it NRT getting younger and younger?
I think that's been the trend.
So, I mean, the hormones
of food. As to what the causes of that I don't know. And again, that's not really my area of expertise, so just because I don't know doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't know. Somebody else may know. Yes, sir.
I think the reason why young people become involved in sexual contact, I think, is because girls are in their teens often persuaded to have sexual intercourse with the boys because they're afraid that they won't be liked and loved if they don't do it. I think it's a very difficult problem because it puts the responsibility of parents of boys to on teaching them something different.
Right.
And for girls to be more firm about it.
Right. I see Mr. Bond in the back of the room. That gives me the opportunity to announce that next week, the next 2 weeks, Mr. Bond and Mr. Haniel are going to be talking about their Uganda trip. So you're going to want to come and hear that, please, next week. So I thank you for your attention very much.